Thanks for listening to The Rest Is Politics. Sign up to The Rest Is Politics Plus to enjoy ad-free listening, receive a weekly newsletter, join our members' chat room, and gain early access to live show tickets. Just go to therestispolitics.com. That's therestispolitics.com.
So this episode is brought to you, I'm delighted to say, by the National Theatre.
Well, did you know, Roy, the National Theatre has its own streaming platform called the National Theatre at Home?
I did not, because I absolutely love the National Theatre. It's one of my favourite things in Britain. So that's terrific. I'm actually going to be able to watch it from my sofa. I'm not going to have to trek out to a theatre.
Well, you and I both love going to theatre. In fact, I'm seeing two plays this week.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Well, the first one was a musical. I saw Standing at the Sky's Edge, which is brilliant. And then Friday, Fiona and I are going to see Nye with Michael Sheen.
I've seen some brilliant stuff by the National recently. Been some amazing collaborations. So this is really exciting. And of course, this is also true that it's a great way of getting access. Don't live in London, or if you're traveling, or if tickets aren't available. So really, really exciting.
They've got some big names on there already. Sir Ian McKellen, who was born in Burnley, by the way. Phoebe Waller-Bridge, Papa Essidu. And they add new plays every month. So at the moment, you can watch Kin, which is about a family's move from Yemen to Palestine in the 1930s, so very relevant today. Or Constellations, which is a play with infinite possibilities, four different casts starring Peter Capaldi,
your
who
friend.
Made his name being me, basically.
Yeah.
Anna Maxwell Martin, Chris O'Dowd, and Russell Tovey. Anna Maxwell Martin, who I happen to know is a massive fan of the podcast.
Lovely.
You can subscribe now for just £9.99 a month.
So to find out more, visit ntathome.com. That's ntathome.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Welcome to The Rest Is Politics with me, Rory Stewart.
And me, Alistair Campbell.
And today, there's actually some really interesting international news. We're going to do France and Germany and the relationship between French President Macron and Chancellor Scholz. We're going to be looking at the Russian elections, which sounds a bit weird, but we'll justify to you why Russian elections are worth looking at. We'll do a little bit on the current problems of the UK Conservative Party and stories over the weekend that there might be a leadership challenge against Rishi Sunak before the end of the year. And then we'll look at the election of a new First Minister to Wales, bringing the first, I think, black leader into leader nation anywhere in Europe. But let's start on France and Germany, which we're lucky enough to have with us a man who loves France and Germany, speaks very good French and German.
Introducing a new guest.
That's right, exactly. So give us a sense on where you think things are, because there are actually very few people I know who've got such a kind of sympathy for both countries and understanding of both in the British world. Yeah.
Well, they had a meeting the other day with Donald Tusk, and it was set up really as this new Prime Minister of Poland, and of course, very well known to both of them because of his leading role in Europe. And I think it came at a very, very difficult time for them. I don't think there's any doubt that they're not soulmates, Macron and Scholz. I think Macron sees himself as a European leadership figure. Scholz is Chancellor of Germany, which is widely seen as the most powerful country in Europe. But they then, things really kicked off when they had this meeting on Ukraine a few weeks ago. And Macron talked about troops on the ground. And Scholz went straight out to say, this is just not going to happen. Macron talked about cowards. He reminded people that...
With a side implication that Scholz might be one of those.
Well, he also reminded people that there were countries at the start of the Ukraine war that talked about sending helmets, which, of course, was Germany. The Germans are very slightly fed up. There's a thing called the Kiel Institute, which does an analysis of who sent what and says that Germany is second behind the United States and France is well down the list. The French have got very uppity about that, saying
here's a figure produced from Germany, which has been repeated in the press, and this will be what's disputed. The claim is that Germany has promised, I guess the word is promised, 17 billion euros worth of munition supplies, and France is providing only 3%. So that's the German view, that France is really not putting its weight. And then presumably the French say that statistic's nonsense and they're putting in more than that.
Well, and they also say that what they're putting in is more effective. So there's the current argument going on, or one of the current arguments going on, is the fact that the British and the French have provided cruise missiles.
Right, which allow you to fire much longer range and accurately.
And the German cruise missiles, this Taurus system, which is deemed to be more effective. Scholz's argument seems to be that if the Germans do provide those, they also have to provide troops who have to be on the ground, and that then is risks being very,
he's saying
very provocative.
They're too complicated to train the Ukrainians in how to use them.
Correct. Now, Ukrainians argue that they could do that. Yeah. Ukrainians have been complaining that lots of these promises from lots of different countries just have not been fulfilled. Anyway, so then had this meeting with Tusk, and they all came out. It's called the Weimar Triangle, the three countries. And they came out. Scholz said unity is strength. Macron said they were united and determined. Tusk said that it shows that all these terrible rumors of bickering are overstated. But you do hear constantly that both personally and the teams do not get on very well.
The history of this is really important because Germany and France have been the engines of European integration since the 40s, since people started first talking about what used to be called a Franco-German Federation. So after the Second World War, these countries, which had been really at loggerheads violently from 1870, when Prussia took Paris and then seized Alsace-Lorraine, and then the French seized the Rhineland. These are disputes about bits of German-speaking territory west of the Rhine. All the way through to the end of the Second World War and after the Second World War, a really concerted attempt made by German and French leadership to get beyond that, and talks actually about single currencies even as early as that, armies, single governments. And this really continued, I think, through a lot of very interesting relationships. So Adenauer and de Gaulle, 58-63, Brandt and Pompidou, Schmidt and Giscard d'Estaing, most dramatically probably Kohl and Mitterrand, 1982-95.
Holding hands. Mm-hmm. Famously.
And then we had Schroeder and Chirac, and then Merkel with Sarkozy, Hollande, and Macron. Most of those relationships seem to sort of work. And this one, well, let me start you on the first thing. Tell me a little bit about your sense of how French-German relationships worked when they were strong, maybe the sort of Kohl, Mitterrand, Schroeder, Chirac eras.
You shouldn't understate, the whole issue of ego in politics. So I think Chirac, Schroeder, who we saw very, very close up, you always had the sense of Chirac being le grand homme, the big guy. But Germany was the big country, and that sort of balanced itself out. I think with Scholz and Macron, it does feel less integrated than those. I think Merkel understood that Macron likes the big moment.
Yeah.
Okay. Scholz is very kind of, quiet, steady, incremental. So when Macron, one of his early statements, and he said that NATO was brain dead.
Yeah.
Which, of course, if Trump said it, we'd be going, this is absolutely terrible. But he said it. And Merkel came out and said to him, look, I'm really fed up of having to sort of, I like your grand gesture. I love that you're a disruptor. But why should I be the one to pick up the pieces afterwards and try and put it all back together again? And I think with Scholz, he just finds the whole big vision thing a bit irritating. So in relation to what's going on with Ukraine, I think he finds it irritating that Germany is spending more money on this. I think he finds it difficult that the French don't understand sufficiently why this is so difficult psychologically for Germany. Interestingly, although Scholz is not doing very well in German public opinion at the moment, the one place where he's doing quite well is in his handling of Ukraine.
Tell us about why it's psychologically difficult for Germany.
I was talking to somebody in Germany yesterday who said that, one of the first things she mentioned was her grandfather in Stalingrad. So their historical experience of war with Russia runs very, 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 very deep. Scholz knows that. You mentioned Willy Brandt there. There's something in the German psyche that thinks that Willy Brandt's Ostpolitik, this sort of let's try and get on with the East, even during the Cold War, was one of the reasons why eventually the Berlin Wall fell. Reagan likes to take the credit, Thatcher likes to take the credit, but I think they think actually it was Germany's more cooperative approach.
Yeah, really interesting, isn't it? Because you're exactly right. The narrative in the States is that the Soviet Union was crushed, the Berlin Wall came down because Reagan was very assertive and confrontational. And as you're saying, there's another narrative that actually the more cooperative approach was what made the difference.
Yeah. And so now, and bear in mind, we're in a European elections year. So Macron feeling under pressure from Le Pen. Le Pen identified as being sort of Putin poodle. And therefore, Macron emphasizing that by we're the tough guys. Meanwhile, Scholz is now presenting himself as Friedenskanzler, the peace chancellor, which again is how Brandt presented himself.
So there's a really interesting difference between these two. They both face a similar challenge, which is that in both cases, the far right and the far left in France and Germany are basically pro-Putin. I mean, in the case of the AfD in Germany, violently pro-Putin. I mean, actually, you know, financial links to Russia, very, very clear that they would turn on the Russian gas again, that it's the cutting off the Russian gas which is driving the cost of living crisis in Germany. They would not provide any weapons to Ukraine and really blaming the US for blowing up the gas lines. So that's the right in Germany.
And by the way, one of the reasons why they're doing particularly well in the East, where there's still that sort of nostalgic, historic sense of, well, we've always been different and we've always been a bit closer to them anyway.
Right. So there's more good feeling there. And actually, I'd like you to bring you back to that, because another factor that Scholz is facing, we talk about election years, but of course, in Germany, it's a bit more complicated. It's a federal country where state elections matter more. And there are going to be elections now in Saxony, Thuringia and Brandenburg, which are significant states, which are in former East Germany, where the far right and the far left are doing well. So we have that in Germany. So you've got this sort of push for peace. And the response from Scholz in Germany is to try to mollify them by being the peace chancellor. In France, you have a similar situation where the right and left are more inclined to take Putin's position on Ukraine. But Macron has decided that his response, instead of mollifying them, is to confront them.
Whereas at the start of the war, he was very much, you know, do you remember the phone calls with Putin and quite warm and quite friendly and trying to bring him in the whole time? And so he has definitely shifted.
And he's become sort of, he's sort of taking a kind of Churchillian tone, isn't he? He's very much, you know, talking more radically than everyone else. We may have to put troops on the ground and all this kind of stuff.
I mean, they've slightly wound back from the troops on the ground. I can remember during Kosovo, the argument about Bodentruppen, as they're called in German. I remember Schröder being very, very agitated by Bodentruppen. But what's happening in relation to Macron, I think he was pushing it. He was saying we should rule nothing out. It got picked up as being they're going to send in ground troops. And he's unwound from that. However, he is definitely out as a pretty hawkish figure on this, and underlining, as Biden did in his State of the Union speech, that if Putin wins in Ukraine, then that will not be the end of the matter. Whereas Germany still don't talk about Ukraine winning. They talk about them not losing. They talk about Putin not winning and Ukraine not losing. And I think the other thing to understand about the Germans is that a close relationship to the United States is a fundamental pillar of their foreign policy. In a way, with France, it's always a little bit more ambiguous.
So we have this almost kind of conflict of personalities, which you've laid out. You know, Macron is a very colourful, provocative figure. Scholz a bit duller. I mean, Scholz really seems, at least from the outside, to really struggle to be able to communicate and dominate a big stage. I wonder whether, I'd like to explore this, whether actually in a funny way, his story doesn't echo Rishi Sunak's. He was the kind of finance minister during COVID, like Rishi Sunak, got a lot of plaudits because he was handing out a lot of money during the COVID period, struggled to win his own party election, found himself inserted as chancellor, and then has really struggled to do the charisma public-facing stuff.
I mean, he's been a kind of pretty big national figure for a long, long time in a way that Rishi Sunak wasn't. It is interesting, though, but if you think about Merkel, she's not what you'd call traditionally charismatic. She's not a Macron or a Chirac. She's more Scholz. She probably has a broader appeal. But I think he has struggled. And I think he's, the word you hear a lot in Germany is that he's disappointed, that he hasn't quite risen to it. He would argue that people knew what they were getting with him. He is the kind of more staid, sober sort of type.
Is that not the Ian Duncan Smith's defense?
The quiet man is turning up the volume. Now, he can do volume. I've seen him do volume. I also I think that Macron does seem to be able to provoke. He provokes strong feelings in other people. Tusk, I think, probably did play a useful role in basically saying to them, listen, you know, this is not good. And there's a very interesting speech. I don't know if you had time to see it. I sent it to you from Merz, who's the opposition leader.
Yeah, you're leading the right-wing CDU party.
Yeah, and he actually made the point. He couldn't think of any chancellor in German history who would have allowed this relationship to become so publicly so difficult. Even Schröder, he said.
So we've talked about the fact that the left in Europe in general has been in trouble. We looked at the statistics since the high point of Tony Blair to today. Fewer and fewer sort of social democratic parties in Europe. And in Germany now, under real threat. So there are three people in the coalition, aren't there? Liberals, Greens, and the
social Democrats.
SPD. And they are doing incredibly badly in the polls. The sort of centre-right party, CDU, is doing very well. AfD, now very strong. So Thuringia, when we're watching these elections this year, they look like they're above 30%.
Yeah.
And probably with this left-wing party, which we haven't discussed much.
The Linke.
Yeah, which is, this is Wagenknecht,
the wife of Oscar Lafontaine. She's like a sort of populist,
so
leftist.
Possibly she, combined with AfD, may get over 50% of the vote in Thuringia.
Mm.
And then you've got these splits within the German coalition. So you've got big chairs of parliamentary committees from the CDU and the Greens putting out joint op-eds attacking Scholz. You've got senior liberals voting against the government. The Green foreign minister clearly seems to be actually more pro-Ukraine and seems to be signaling she would be sending tourists. So, and then you've got this weird phrase coming out of the SPD where they're talking about freezing the conflict, the leader in parliament. And nobody quite knows what freezing the conflict means.
Well, I think it's back to this point about is, you know, nobody wins, nobody loses. You just kind of hold the line on it. Just maybe as a bridge into talking a bit about the Russian election, just on the last poll, 60% of Germans oppose supplying Ukraine with these Taurus missiles, 60%. And that's up from 49 in February. 20% of Germans think they should be doing more to support Ukraine. 40% think they've sent enough weapons, and 40% think he's gone too far.
So Scholz is very much in line with a public that's getting increasingly sort of cold feet about getting involved. The other thing that I think has been really interesting is the way that German politics is all about Ukraine and very, very little about Gaza amongst the political parties themselves. It's not like Britain, where it feels as though Israel-Gaza is actually a much more important international issue in defining politics than Ukraine today.
But it's closer, isn't it? He is open about saying he does not want to provoke Putin into thinking that Germany's also in his sights. And he's saying that.
And the Gaza thing, though, is interesting. You quoted 60%. Mm. 60% of the German population want an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. Not a single political party is even talking about that. So there's a huge gap emerged between all the political parties and Germans, particularly younger Germans.
Mm. But again, just as they feel emotionally, the Russian issue affects them much more deeply. Likewise, I can remember Angela Merkel always used to say the two absolute fundamentals of her foreign policy, apart from Europe, were closeness to America and absolute support for Israel because of the history that brought Israel into being.
And presumably that could change. I mean, there's a very big Muslim population in Germany.
Yeah.
Young people are taking a very, very different view of this.
Yeah.
Okay, on to Russia.
Right, so, Rory, Putin won. We got that one right.
We predicted.
We knew he was going to win.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we're getting few too many right. It was a little bit too easy to predict that Bangladesh was going to go in the direction it was. It was a little bit too easy. It's a bit easy to predict India, where Modi's going to win.
Yeah.
UK, absolutely confident in my predictions.
I know you are. But I think there is a paradox between the fact we're having more and more elections with more and more people voting, but we're not necessarily a more democratic world. And it was interesting when Putin announced that he'd won almost 90% of the vote, which was just about 12% lower than Saddam Hussein got in his biggest triumph when he got 100% of the vote. I think Kim Jong-un's record was 99%.
Yeah, it's good when you get over 100. That's when you really
you know, you really, really won
it. Yeah.
But it was interesting who congratulated and who didn't. So North Korea, China, Venezuela,
Iran.
They sent their heartfelt congratulations. Modi in India.
Yeah, warm congratulations from India.
Yeah.
Congratulations from UAE.
Yeah.
Now, so India and UAE, sort of obviously more surprising than Venezuela, Iran, and North Korea. And really does suggest, you know, these are countries where, you know, UAE, India are really meant to be part of the sort of America would hope, you know, your friend Jamie Rubin would very much
talk. Your friend, your friend.
My friend Jamie Rubin would very much want to emphasize that the balance against China in the Pacific is India and that the US relationship with UAE is very strong. But it's very, very challenging for the US when an election has happened, which is... I mean, just to talk people through how bizarre it is. Essentially, Putin was supposed to step down, supposed to finish as president in 2008. And he did this strange thing of putting Medvedev, who was the prime minister, in as president from 2008 to 2012, when he became the prime minister.
I think we all know who was in power then.
Yeah. And then he came back again, technically in 2012, same time as Xi Jinping, and then changed the whole constitution in 2020 to allow himself to run for at least two more six-year terms. So it now feels like he's president for life. He runs against him every time, a few sort of candidates, but they're never a threat. So he had three candidates. He had a communist, he had a nationalist, and then there's this weird party that's been created called the New People's Party. All these people get a tiny percentage of the vote.
One of them, their main policy was execution of all Ukrainian prisoners of war.
Right, yeah, that
so
was the nationalist.
Not exactly...
Yeah, Slavitsky, I think, yeah.
Yeah, not exactly challenging the central narrative.
And Karitonov, I think, you know, real kind of old communist. But you can sort of see what the former KGB, the FSB, is doing there. You know, let's have one party which is communist, one which is ultra-nationalist, and one called the New People's Party, which sounds as though it might be sort of liberal democratic, although actually it's massively pro-the occupation of Ukraine.
We talked on the Q&A, was it last week or the week before, about why do these dictators hold elections? But you could see from the way they presented it, if you're a Russian citizen who just watches state TV, you think, oh, this is an election and Putin's won again, and they all look very happy. And he's then out using this to say, I've now got popular support for any reforms I bring forward in the future, many of which will be more repressive, and I've got popular support for the war in Ukraine.
So it's very helpful. If he doesn't do it, he doesn't have this wonderful opportunity of a kind of festival of the people, doesn't have the events to turn up and can't claim those mandates.
Yeah. And even though he's surrounded by voices from America, Europe, saying this is not a free and fair election, people in Russia are not hearing that in the main.
I wonder from a propaganda point of view, actually, whether those kind of states wouldn't want to hold elections even more frequently if they're quite useful ways of appearing on a stage, mobilizing people.
Well, the fact that we, you know, you could argue that we shouldn't really call it an election because it's not an election in the way that we would understand it.
Yeah.
And yet we talk about, you know, Putin winning another term, like he's been democratically re-elected.
It's more like a sort of medieval royal procession, isn't it? Maybe, you know, I think kings would sort of come through the streets of London every 3-4 years to get people cheering and give us sort of a general sense. Yeah.
It was very interesting as well, when they played the national anthem, he reminded me of, you know, sometimes you see footballers who look like they don't quite know the words.
Yeah.
He looked at like he was sort of mumbling the national anthem. And I wonder whether he now in his head is so grand that he shouldn't even have to sing it because essentially it's about him. It's very much he is the state now.
Even more troubling would be if he's beginning to slightly lose the plot so that we can have a fantastic kind of, you know, slightly elderly, doddery people.
Gerontocracies of all the world, over the world unite. Yeah. Yeah. What, Kim Jong-un becomes the only young one.
On Putin, I mean, I guess it makes me wonder whether we're not slightly missing our labeling and that we shouldn't be talking about an age of monarchies coming back, that Erdogan, Putin, Modi, Xi Jinping, if you were a Martian looking at us, you might think these things actually resemble more kind of kings, the way that monarchies used to operate than what we call a democracy.
Who are the successors?
Yeah, can they get their kids lined up as a question?
That Trump would. But I don't know who Putin's successor would be. And I think part of his strengthening of his power within Russia is that there's nobody. I mean, there's nobody that anybody is talking about as a possible successor.
Does Vladimir Putin have children lining up succession? I mean, what's going on there?
He has, I don't know that he has any sons. He has two daughters that we definitely know about who are now they'll be in their 30s because when Putin and his then wife, Ludmilla, came to London, he brought the kids. My daughter, Grace, does a whole comedy sketch about how the wife wanted to go shoe shopping and Grace advised them to go to Clark's. But I don't think Mrs. Putin was really into Clark's shoes. But they even back then, they were absolutely paranoid.
How old was Grace at this stage?
Grace was, well, this was, she'd have been a child, and they were children.
So her advice on Clark's was based on
It wasn't based on fashion. It wasn't based on fashion. But I remember even back then, although their daughters were quite small, they'd be, you know, late 10, 12, something like that. They were paranoid about them not being photographed.
And Grace went shoe shopping with them?
No, they didn't go shoe shopping. They went on the London Eye. All three of my kids, with Putin's kids, went on the London Eye and sort of wandered around there with Cherie and Fiona and Mrs. Putin. Mrs. Putin didn't look very happy with Vlad, I have to say, right. A lot of the time.
It's a bit of the sort of Melania feeling.
Not quite as bad as that, but it didn't feel close.
Yeah.
And anyway, that's now gone. I'm not sure what the daughters do now. There are rumours that he's got other kids with other women.
He went out, am I right, is ice skater or a ballerina or something?
I think it was a ballerina that he was sort of quite friendly with and maybe still is.
Maybe I'm confusing the fact that he's an amazing ice hockey player, isn't he?
It says he is. Yeah, that's wins right. Every year. Yeah. Has an annual match where he always scores the winning goal.
And does he play famous ice hockey players like you playing Maradona?
I don't think there is an ice hockey player as quite as famous as Maradona. But yeah, he plays with the best.
He beats the best.
He plays with the best.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and they organise it so he always wins.
Can I just very quickly on this before we go to the break? The president of Afghanistan, I remember once doing this, Ashraf Ghani, invited up to the presidential palace. And Ashraf was a kind of a man with a doctorate who'd been a professor at Sir John Hopkins in his early 60s, and he invited up the Afghan Olympic sprinting team. And he said to these young men, you know, I'm pretty good at sprinting. I'm going to race you. And so these 18, 19-year-old Afghans are like, what? And so in the front of the presidential palace, Ashraf Ghani takes off his shoes and in his shalwar kameez stands at the start line with these sort of astonished 18-year-olds. And they set off. And the president manages, I think, about six steps before he falls on his face.
Did he honestly think he could win?
It was the moment where I thought there is something genuinely wrong. Yeah, genuinely wrong. Because actually, it's not even as though he's a particularly sporty individual. He's not just 40 years older than me. He's a kind of slightly weedy.
Did you see, talking of politicians and sport, did you see Rishi Sunak and the rugby team?
No.
Oh my God.
I mean, that sounds like a bad moment. I mean, why would you put Rishi with this rugby team? Anyone less like a rugby?
Well, because he's on a permanent campaign mode, but this rugby player, but you know when Tony Blair headed the ball with Kevin Keegan 28 times or whatever. Kevin Keegan is such a good footballer, he could literally plop it onto his head every time. This rugby player threw the ball at Rishi Sunak in such a way as a two-year-old could have caught it, okay? But sadly, Rishi Sunak is clearly not two because he couldn't hold the ball.
One sort of would have predicted that he's not likely. And you can't really see him as kind of rugby club guy.
No.
He doesn't have that kind of that air, does he?
No. Anyway, there we are. I suppose the other sort of maybe finally on Russia, that it was interesting, albeit possibly just an expression of kind of the impotence of dealing with this guy. It was quite interesting, that protest, that, you know, the word went around the world at 12 o'clock.
Noon against Putin.
Stand in line somewhere.
Yeah, one of Navalny's last requests was people would show their protest against Putin by turning up at polling booths at midday, because as he pointed out, the regime could hardly stop you turning up to vote at midday.
Yeah.
You could claim that just when you got off from work.
Yeah. So the queue here, I didn't see it, but I was speaking to somebody who was outside the Russian embassy here in London and said it went right, you know, on for a couple of miles. So, I mean, that was a sense of protest. But, you know, if you remember one of his previous elections, it led to pretty close to riots. People were out on the streets protesting. Well, I didn't see much of that this time. All right, Roy, quick break, and then we'll come back.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
The holidays have arrived early with Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters. We have your patio covered too. And get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Welcome back to The Rest is Politics with me, Rory Stewart.
And me, Alistair Campbell.
And we were going to talk briefly about the fact that the front page of the Sunday newspapers this week was reporting that there were going to be an uprising against Rishi Sunak and that some Conservative MPs were thinking of replacing him. And then there were a lot of quotes from Penny Mordaunt saying, I don't know where this has come from, nothing to do with me, I wasn't intending to run. And then various sort of Tory grandees all on the record saying, this is a suicidal idea, why would we topple our leader just before an election? I guess this goes back to something we've been talking about for a few months, where there are a fringe of Conservatives out there who even fantasize about bringing back Boris Johnson. And I suppose what they're doing is they're 20 points behind in the polls. They're not making any progress. At the moment, they're going into election where they're going to get wiped out. So there must be some of them thinking, well, why not spin the dice again? How bad could this be? I mean, we can't lose worse than we're currently losing. Why don't we try again in the hope that someone else...
I think they could lose worse. Given how bad they've been, I sometimes look at the polls and think, who are these 22% of people who are still thinking of voting Tory? I mean, what earthly reason?
So what would you say if, you know, let's say I'm going to put you in an unfair position, imagining you're in number 10, and Tory backbench MPs can come in and say, listen, the truth is, we're toast. We're going to lose lots of seats. We're going to lose this election. Rishi Sunak isn't going to change between now and the election. He can't possibly win. Why don't we spin the dice again, try to bring in someone else in the hope that they might do a bit better?
The argument against it is that it could make things even worse. And if you look at the two names that are constantly being bandied about, Penny Mordaunt and Kemi Badenoch, it's really interesting how I look at them and just think they're not very good. And it's like with Kemi Badenoch, let's just go with her for a minute. So she made a lot of waves last week when she came out at a time when Sunak and Number 10 were refusing to say that Frank Hester, their £10 million, £15 million donor, was racist in what he said about Diane Abbott should be shot and she makes me hate all black women. Profoundly, straightforwardly racist, but Number 10 can't bring themselves to say that.
So it's a repeat, isn't it, of what was going on with Anderson last week, which is they say it's wrong, but they're not prepared to say racist. And I think with Anderson, it was it's wrong, but they're not prepared to say why it's wrong. It's
this now what they've said with Hester is it was wrong, but he's apologized. Well, all he's apologized for, he said it was rude. He's not acknowledged. He has not himself acknowledged that what he said was racist.
And I watched Graham Stewart, who's a master in energy, doing it. So his phrase was, it's profoundly reprehensible. And then, of course, the interviewer keeps saying,
well, why can you keep the money then? Why, profoundly reprehensible?
And presumably the answer is £15 million is a lot of money.
And they probably spent a lot of it already. So Kemi Badenoch comes out and says it is racist. And lots of people come out and say, well done, Kemi, speaking as it is. And yet she was out yesterday on Monday doing the media round, suddenly deciding, I don't want to be talking about this anymore. Why are you still asking me questions about this? And of course, the answer to that is because you lot still haven't cleared this up. You still haven't explained how you can keep the money. But I think what had happened is she thought, maybe I need to be a little bit more in that space where all the hard right are.
And she's also been issuing press releases, taking credit for stuff, which then Number 10 the following day are issuing press releases with the Prime Minister's quotes, which is a real sign of her pushing for leadership. And she, like Suella Braverman, is an example of somebody in Rishi Sunak's cabinet, and I absolutely hear this directly from his cabinet, who he does not rate. He doesn't think she's a good minister, but he feels, for some reason, he has to keep her in order to deal with the party politics, deal with the right.
Well, I promise you,
and
right,
that was a mistake he made with Suella Braverman.
Absolutely.
Isn't it? Yeah.
And it's a mistake he made with Lee Anderson. I mean, the only reason anybody knows who Lee Anderson is because Rishi Sunak gave
promoted
him this
him.
Job as deputy chairman of the Tory party.
So if you had been Rishi Sunak's advisor and he kept saying to you, I think Kemi Badenoch's no good, but don't talk to me about her because I have to keep her, your view would be brave, get rid of her if you think she's no good.
Well, look, I think there was a moment where Sunak had an opportunity to show a bit of strength. We've talked about this before. First of all, in differentiating himself from Johnson and Truss, he failed to do that. Then again, when the Johnson Privileges Committee report came, he failed to do that. And likewise, I think they all listen too much to this rubbish that gets talked in the kind of right-wing media ecosystem. Anybody who watched Badenoch's interview, I think it was with Robert Peston yesterday, just watch that interview. You're looking at somebody who's just not very good at this. Penny Mordaunt, I mean, great. She held a big sword during the coronation and she looked great. But if you actually watch her in the House of Commons when she's doing the sort of weekly Commons questions, she's not that great. So what they're doing is they've gone from Cameron, May, Johnson, Truss, Sunak. At every point, you take papers like the Mail, the Express, they're saying, this is our saviour. This is the one that's going to do it. They're now building up a new one. They're going to be just as bad. So I think actually they could make it worse. Now, they might get a short-term hit. People go, oh, this is new, this is interesting. But honestly, the country's just had enough of this.
And I think,
by the way, Rory,
it would also look ridiculous, wouldn't it? Because your immediate response, if they did that, would be, okay, this is totally illegitimate. We've had, whatever it is, three prime ministers since the last election, or four.
Yeah, it'd be the fourth.
And this is a joke.
Yeah,
we need
Rory,
an election now.
This would mean we'll have had six prime ministers since 2010. The Labour Party has had six prime ministers in our entire history. I mean, it's mad. It's utterly insane.
And of course, you get a new prime minister, immediately a new strategy is announced, a new cabinet's announced, every department.
And it's just, but it's all showbiz for ugly people.
Yeah.
It's not actually going to change the fundamentals.
Yeah.
This is the difference between, I think, where the public are and where much of our media is still portraying this like a serious party of government. I mean, to be fair to Sunak, the one thing I'll give him, he gets out there every day. He tries to do stuff. He's not a great communicator, but he's out there. And I'd find it very difficult to be out there. There'd be a part of me that'd be tempted to say, look, you lot are an ungovernable rabble. I'm off. But he can't do that. He's got to fight an election. But I think that you've talked before about these sort of six, seven different groupings within the Conservative Party now. They're not operating like a coherent United Party. And in an election year, that's death. Even I, Roy, am beginning to think they can't possibly get back from this. That being said, I still think Labour have to do more. I really liked Keir Starmer's art speech. I wish that had got a bit more coverage. But I was in Yorkshire. I did three fundraisers last week for Labour candidates. And I was up in Yorkshire at the weekend in Leeds, in the neighbouring constituency to Rachel Reeves, with party members and party supporters. And do you know what the single most raised issue was where they wanted to hear more from Labour?
European Union?
Correct.
Yeah, well, I couldn't agree more.
Brexit.
We had actually a very interesting time last week. We spoke in Methodist Central Hall, you and I, to 1,500 high school students.
High school? Which country are you living in now?
Oh, I'm sorry, secondary school. Secondary school students. And we recorded the podcast there, but didn't really have much of a chance to talk about it. I found it really interesting because they were overwhelmingly expecting Keir Starmer to win, and I think overwhelmingly would vote for Keir Starmer. But boy, oh boy, we struggled to get them to stick up their hands for anything that they thought he was doing, which excited them. So then I thought, well, maybe this is because he's not talking enough about the environment. And I couldn't have been more wrong. Because when we asked the crowd, how many of you think climate and the environment, these are 16 to 18 year olds, think climate and environment is the number one issue going to the election, probably only about a quarter of the hands went up.
Yeah. They were very focused, I think, on inequality, cost of living.
And that's really interesting electorally, because you would have thought the really core vote driving climate and the environment would be younger people. And if they're beginning to say actually cost of living is more important, because obviously a lot of older people have been saying that for a long time, that's a really interesting in terms of what that means for net zero, the investment we put in, the amount of taxes you put on people, the amount you put up fuel prices.
Mm. There was a poll this week of, I think, 18 to 30-year-olds. It's now Labour 70, Tories 7.
70 to 7 is pretty extreme. Okay.
Now, what about Wales? So Wales has got, as you said earlier, Europe's first black leader, Vaughan Gething, the son of a vet. His dad, white, married a woman, a farmer in Zambia when he was working there. And Vaughan Gething, who's, you know, come up through the Labour ranks in Wales. Quite a controversial election. Him against Jeremy Miles, who was the education minister, and the only time the campaign really took off nationally across the UK was in relation to a donation.
Yeah.
£200,000 from a guy who'd been convicted of environmental offences.
Now, given to Vaughan Gething.
Yeah. Peanuts when you look at it set alongside Frank Custer, Carwin Jones, one of his predecessors as First Minister, said that when he ran for the leadership, his campaign cost about £15,000 in total.
Yeah.
So there's that.
200,000 serious money.
And also the other thing that's happened, there's a meeting, I think it might be today, but the Welsh Assembly members are meeting. I think he did far better amongst the trade unions than amongst the members and amongst the elected representatives.
Let's just develop that for a second.
It's a tricky start.
So Vaughan Gething was the youngest ever, I think, president of the Trade Union Congress in Wales. He was a lawyer with Thompson's, which does a lot of trade union work. And he was up against Jeremy Miles. And Jeremy Miles is a fluent Welsh speaker, then went to New College, Oxford. Like Vaughan Gething, a lawyer, part of this thing, I guess, Tony Blair and Keir Starmer lawyers, coming in to replace Mark Drakeford, who we did a great leading interview with, if people wanted to listen to again, who is much more of a sort of academic professorial figure, you know, it's a very kind of intellectual figure. And the real moment of scandal was they both went to the hustings with Unite, which is a powerful trade union, to get the endorsement of Unite. Jeremy Miles turns up, does his hustings, and at the end of the hustings, as the vote's about to happen, Unite say, oh, but by the way, Jeremy Miles, just to explain, we should inform you now that you're not actually eligible to stand and all our votes have to go to Vaughan Gething, leaving Jeremy Miles thinking, what on earth is this? You know, I've been invited to this hustings, and now I'm told, for some obscure rule change the previous summer to do with whether you're a lay member of Unite, I'm not eligible. And that then got Rodri Morgan's wife coming out, remembering what had happened in 1999, where again, Alan Michael had defeated Rodri Morgan, again with trade union votes. So she took to Twitter saying, this is the same stitch up happening in Wales yet again.
There was a little bit of central, Labour central hand in the Alan Michael.
Alan Michael was more New Labour.
Yeah.
He was the New Labour guy. And Jeremy Miles ran against our friend Stephen Kinnock, lost by one vote.
Yeah.
Do you have any sense, are they in exactly the same part of the Labour Party, or are they slightly different traditions? Or
Jeremy Miles and Vaughan Gething. I don't think ideologically there was that much of a difference, but I think that Vaughan Gething, his opponents are saying that he won essentially through what they call trade union stitch up. And it was very close. I mean, it was a rerun of the Brexit. It was almost 52% against almost 48%.
And being a trade union person, it doesn't necessarily mean you're particularly left or right. I mean, what does it mean? It means
you can get, there is a very right-wing trade union tradition as well as a left-wing tradition. But I think with Vaughan Gething, it was very interesting to me how he focused a lot in his campaign on education, as if that wasn't going very well. Jeremy Miles being the education minister, and Jeremy Miles focused an awful lot on the Welsh economy.
Right.
Vaughan Gething having been in charge of the economy. So it wasn't a big ideological battle. As I say, the only issues that took off really were about the extent to which they were going to represent any sense of time for change.
And I guess if you're Jeremy Miles and you're trying to challenge Vaughan Gething's backing the trade unions, you might suggest that maybe he's less open to big dramatic regulatory change which challenges the trade unions.
Yeah, but I don't think I'm not sure he was really, really pushing it. Look, I think at the start it was felt that Vaughan Gething was a runaway favourite, and by the end it got very, very close, and it was dominated by these two questions, this donation and then the role of the trade unions.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to be it's a very narrow win. Quite a lot of healing to be done, I would say. The elected representatives feeling a little bit put out. So he's going to have to rebuild that. And then, of course, there are these big issues. You know, you've got the steel, Port Talbot, you've got the steelworks under threat, you've got the health service you know, which is used as a political football nationally by the Tories. You've got some pretty tough education challenges. So it's not an easy place to be. He did get, by the way, I mean, I was looking at a lot of my German media. There were quite big profiles of him because, of course, you know, first black European leader is a pretty big thing. But that was the sort of tone, as opposed to this is a clear signal of change of direction post-Drakeford. I think he's going to have to work that out as he goes.
Small conclusion, I think, again, reinforcing something we talk about a lot on the podcast, which is the real urgent necessity of stopping the way that parties are financed in Britain. I was really struck that you saw in Australia a premier who's trying to ban all contributions to political parties. But in a week in which we've had Hester giving £15 million, I mean, sort of regardless of his racist comments, which were completely horrible, he's obviously a horrible human being, but £15 million is a ridiculous sum of money. I mean, I can't even imagine. He must be giving 10 times as much as the nearest closest donor. And that gives you so much influence. I mean,
it's that which makes number 10 say to all these ministers, go out and defend him.
And if you can imagine, it's not just defending him from his comments. I don't know what it means in terms of his influence over policy and things. I mean, you cannot take £15 million from somebody. Which you know, in a normal election would be about half your entire election campaign budget.
Oh, yeah.
Without expecting them to have a really strong influence. And this is the conflict of interest stuff. This is why we must stop this stuff. Because either you get, you know, if you want to be balanced about it, I'll try to be balanced about it. The problem is the Conservatives end up getting money from business and finance. Labour end up getting huge amounts of money to the trade unions. But there's also a question of you suddenly see international issues entering British politics because, you know, some donors want to focus on the Pakistani view on Kashmir or want to focus on a particular position on Israel, Gaza. I mean, it really distorts your politics, this money. Mm. And we've got to find a way of getting a grip on it. It cannot make sense.
But I wonder if the reason why the government came along and almost without debate in Parliament, doubled the limit was because they knew they had this £15 million coming down the track.
Yeah.
And Labour, of course, now are having to go out and try and do more fundraising to try to catch up because they know that this stuff can be effective in the campaign.
Yeah, we've got to get, if Keir Starmer comes in, we've got to use that majority to really sort this out. I know it's going to be difficult because when you've won, you know, it's tempting to think, okay, I don't want a turkey voting for Christmas, but this is an opportunity. It's a complete scandal, this sort of money.
And I think people would go, I think although state funding is difficult, like, you know, last week MPs got a pay rise and there was the usual sort of outcry. But I think in the end, if we don't fix the basis of the fundamental system, then we're in trouble.
Final plug, if people are really interested in this, there's an amazing book written by a journalist in the FT looking at the funding provided by a man called Mohamed Amersi to the Conservative Party, which went to a lot of the leading Conservative candidates and then led to him suing various candidates, claiming he'd been defamed. But it's a very, very beautifully written, complicated account of how money works within that party. And I think that should add, this is Tom Burgess's book should add to our campaign to clean up money in British politics.
Good. Well, Tom Burgess is constantly reminding me of his very good books. We've now given it a very good plug, I'd say.
Well, that's brought us sadly to the end, but we'll be back with Question Time tomorrow.
See you soon.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
The first teller of my story is me.
This week on Disorder.
In this new world, when military power will be connected with high tech, small states can be very, very powerful.
Could small states help order the world?
Small states could be as effective, as dangerous as the big ones.
To find out, we're joined by Dr. Armen Sarkisian, Armenia's former president and prime minister.
In our two-part series, we discuss the history of the Armenian genocide,
the ongoing conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh,
and why small states could be the answer to the disorder in our world.
The big powers today have to compete in order to attract the small states to be their allies.
Search Disorder wherever you get your podcasts.